Greetings, my dear listeners. This is TJ Martineau with the New Adventures of the Mountain Pass podcast, coming to you from my living room, not my war room, in my Fortress Americana in the heart of Cascadia. The date is March 20th, 2024. And this is the nuclear fallout episode. I guess it's the best way to describe it. You know, back during the Cold War days, there was the obsession over the idea of what a nuclear fallout or nuclear war would look like. And I was on Twitter recently, on the Twittersphere, and there was somebody who was wargaming what a nuclear fallout against Russia would look like. And then somebody from Russia was wargaming what a nuclear fallout in America would look like. And of course, this is when all the traffic outside my house decides to disappear out of nowhere like cockroaches. And somebody posted an article to a 1970s article that had been written by some government agency of some kind about like a fictional story of a town, Charlottesville, Virginia, what the life would be like for someone there in the aftermath of a nuclear fallout. And one of the things I noted as I was reading this story is that it was far less depressing than I had imagined. And I don't mean that in the sense that the people experiencing the aftermath were living wonderful lives. And it wasn't that they were living easy lives. And it wasn't that they were living comfortable lives. And it wasn't that they had no hardships. What I found the most intriguing from the perspective of somebody in the year 2024 is that there's no confusion amongst the people experiencing the fallout of a nuclear war that the nuclear war had occurred, that it had killed millions of people, that it had destroyed massive amounts of infrastructure, and that they were going to need to start rebuilding if they were going to survive. And the people that were dead were dead. That is my clock. There's a lot of ambient noises here that serves to test my ability to stay focused on the task at hand, which is providing this podcast episode for you, dear listeners. So the people who are dead are dead. The people who are dying, no one's confused about why they're dying. There's no ambivalence or confusion or debate. These people are not arguing and debating over what happened, what's happening, and what they need to do. And there's no rioting. There's some degree of crime going on or black market stuff, but this is, again, the overall general impression I got reading this short story that was supposed to be a wargaming scenario of a nuclear fallout and what life would be like for a town that did not get directly hit by a nuclear missile. And again, the quality that I appreciated was the acknowledgement, the general acknowledgement of reality, that there had been a nuclear war, that it had destroyed much of the country, and yet the societal institutions that had existed prior was keeping the social fabric together. Institutions that perhaps had no physical manifestations anymore, but the intangible effects of those institutions was creating enough external pressures inwardly that people were working together, that people were collaborating, that government infrastructure was starting to get put back up, that people were had not given in to despair. I'm going to pour myself a cup of tea that's been brewing, so take a moment to pause and reflect on what I just said, because it's going to be relevant. All right, that's enough for now. The reason I thought about that is I've been going through a lot of old family videos, and I've also been perusing some of my, for lack of a better word, my ancestors' personal papers that I happen to have inherited. And these personal papers were things like copies of speeches. He was a bigwig at General Electric years ago. We're talking like a good century ago. And he had the speeches of the CEO. He had the speeches of the people they had invited to speak. That he had one of the things that struck me was the number of social clubs that he belonged to. I mean, had a copy of his obituary, and it had a list of everything that he had been involved in. He was involved in, like, we're talking 24 different organizations. He was set on college boards. He was everything, all these different social institutions that no longer exist or would not have him on their leadership board if it killed them. Because this was not a aggrieved victim status seeking loser. This was a highly competent engineer who worked his way up the ladder from essentially poverty to becoming an incredibly wealthy man. But you can feel the effects of these institutions in watching, say, family videos, or you're looking at different events that used to take place socially. You look at how people are interacting with each other. And then you look at what has happened to those institutions since. And there's all that discussion people have had about a culture war and a war on this and a war on that. And I think that that actually is probably not the way I would describe it anymore. I would describe it more on par with the opposite of a neutron bomb. So a neutron bomb is a nuclear weapon that has a very small blast radius, but it has a very high amount of radiation. So the intent of a neutron bomb is kind of like what they call a pinch or an EMP. Except it's intended to kill people. The EMP is intended to destroy anything that relies on an electrical circuit. A neutron is intended to preserve the infrastructure and kill the people. And we can argue over the analogies and which one is more literally closer to reality, which one's more rhetorically effective. I would describe what's been going on over the last how many decades as it's not a culture war, it's a nuclear war. It's a cultural, social, nuclear war. Where instead of one big nuclear blast, just like with a actual nuclear war, you would not have just one big bomb. You would have thousands of tiny little nuclear bombs landing and hitting different targets all across the country. And the effect is that it hasn't killed people in a literal sense, but what it's done is destroy the institutions. And all the things that used to be a part of society. Let's give an example of this. Let's say, and I understand that this was a work of fiction, but it's a a work of fiction that's based in a reality, a historical time period. And the example that I think of is It's a Wonderful Life. And this is a 19, you know, the scene is set in 1920s. George Bailey and his brother are going to his high school senior prom or homecoming or whatever it is. And they're all dressed up in tuxedos and the girls are all dressed up very formally. And there's swing dancing and a big band. And there's all the, you know, older people who are there. And it's a very formal party. I cannot, this is pure speculation on my part, because I have not been to a senior homecoming or prom or whatever in a very long time, since high school. But I imagine it's closer to a five-year-old's birthday party than what you saw in It's a Wonderful Life. And we saw the death of many of these institutions during the lockdowns. I don't call it a pandemic. I just call it a lockdown, because what made it so devastating was the lockdowns. Because I remember reading about how you had high school seniors who spent their graduation ceremonies or their prom, whatever it was, they held them in their cars because they were not allowed to meet. You had all these different institutions where they did not allow them to occur. And if they did, it was in a very sacrilege manner that just killed the spirit and purpose of the entire thing. And I guess what it showed was the triviality that the leaders and those in charge place on these institutions. If they are not, in fact, actively hostile. Some people would argue that there has been subversion and infiltration. Okay, guys, I get that. We could use the cancer analogy. I'm using more of a nuclear fallout, except everyone's in denial about what's happened. And this is the part that I'm getting at, that I want to focus on, is that people are in denial and are ignoring the effects of this fallout. I really should have recorded this podcast in my war room. I will not be making that mistake again, because it seems like everybody and their aunt is outside. I mean, if you were to talk to some parent today and they're wondering what's wrong with kids, you say, well, here's all the, like, write down everything that you had as a kid, the things that you got to enjoy, the opportunities that you had that they haven't had and might and will probably never have. Again, this is an analogy that I'm using, because yes, kids can go and explore all the freedom of the internet and go online. But we all know that that's not a freedom. It's a giant prison now. Because it's not an option. It's the only option for many kids. It's their only way to socialize. If they can't go gather together and go do stuff. And it's not because they're not allowed to. It's that others have been conditioned to only do what they are told. And it's very much like this, I don't know if this is apocryphal or just a parable, but in the days of the circus, one more institution that we don't have anymore really, the baby elephants would be, their legs would be chained. And by the time they were adults, the circus handlers would just use just regular rope. And the reason is because by the time the elephant had reached that stage in life, they had accepted that they were not going to be able to break free, so they didn't even try. So after a certain age, a child has effectively given up trying to assert themselves in an independent manner. And frankly, I'm seeing a lot of this with people in my age group as millennials, where they are very much confined to these small, very small spaces, physically, if not emotionally and psychologically. And the complete lack of spontaneity that seems to exist within what I'm observing. And this is in part people trying to avoid confronting a reality that they don't want to accept. I mean, I'm reading a story about how there's been a nuclear fallout and millions of people have perished. Historical buildings have been destroyed. And yet the people in this war game scenario are just trying to rebuild and recover. Because they still... This is work of fiction, so let's just accept that and not get too hung up on it. But what the paper was trying to convey is that the people still had a sense of who they were and didn't need direction from some higher up in order to realize that they needed to take action themselves. There wasn't an acknowledgement of that if somebody tried to interfere with those efforts that people were going to die. In contrast, how many people died during the lockdowns as a direct result of the lockdowns? I mean, this is the thing, we all know at this point, but some of us always knew, that there was absolutely no reason to have a lockdown. I mean, this was the equivalent of us launching a nuclear missile on ourselves just because we freaked out over a local gang problem or something that was just completely lopsided in terms of the problem and the solution. But the lockdowns didn't start it, it finished it. This is how I view it, is that the lockdowns really completed the death, the final nail in the coffin for many institutions, where it revealed how quickly they can be destroyed, how quickly they can be taken away, and how little those who have control of them are willing to fight for them. I mean, there's that whole discussion about why so many people after the lockdowns don't attend church anymore. And it's because they all instinctively grasp that the lockdowns were not necessary, didn't make any sense scientifically or medically. And yet these churches were not meeting at private homes. Their attitude was the only place that you can worship. The only place we can worship is in a corporately 501c3 approved building space. Because imagine if a pastor had just said, "Hey, they're telling us we can't open the church for worship, so we're just going to worship at our at a house." Or feel free to gather people at your places, but we're going to continue. This institution will be maintained because it's that important. If your institution can be shut down over a virus with a 99.99% survival rate that mainly killed people who were physically obese and over the age of 60, your institution probably isn't that valuable. It's not that important. When your institution is shut down, but liquor stores and weed shops remain open, those institutions matter. Those are your churches now. So that's what we're living in, at least in states like mine where there was a severe lockdown. We're living in the fallout of that situation. And the problem is people are in denial about what happened, what's happening, and what needs to be done. And in terms of what needs to be done, it really comes down to this. These institutions need to be revived by people who are willing to fight for them. I mean, something as simple as a knife and fork club, which my great-grandfather was a member of. It was some organization where they would meet 5 times a year for a formal dinner and listen to a speaker. And it was a national chain. I don't know if it's still in existence. Or you have all these social clubs where you have standards. You have basic levels of manners and decorum. I mean, this is part of the nuclear fallout, is this toxic inclusivity in which anyone and everyone must be included in every space and no one is allowed to be excluded. That's part of the fallout. Because when everyone belongs, nobody belongs. And so when an institution is forced to accept everyone, it excludes everyone. But the problem isn't just forming these institutions again. The problem is that people are incredibly reluctant to assert themselves in that way because they've been conditioned as a result of everything that's occurred over the last 30 years to not do anything without the approval of some, in a superstitious way, the approval of some higher up. You know, you can't have informal gatherings anymore. You need to go to a corporately approved or business approved or formal space in order to do anything. But the main part is people accepting and coming to terms with reality, because as long as they remain in denial, they're going to remain in a perpetual state of the now, the present, where every day it's kind of a version of Groundhog Day where every single day is the same and nothing has changed. I mean, part of this is also this is a reality, is that people have been using the internet, myself included, as a crutch. We've used it as a way to avoid doing the hard work in real life of building the kind of connections that allows us to create an institution or a whether it's just an informal gathering. And I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying it will be easy. It will be probably difficult just getting people to get past that level of anxiety and discomfort. I think part of it is they realize that if something becomes becomes too powerful, it's going to get shut down somehow, some way. I mean, when you have women's knitting clubs being purged of political dissidents, or you have hiking groups where somebody comes in and demands to be included and makes a big stink on social media, this is where when you form stuff, you keep your mouth shut and you don't talk about it. But it also, I guess it just goes back to, people have to start acting a little bit more mature and not rely on formal structures to keep them in line. Some of you might not be shocked. Some of you will probably say, yeah, I deal with this too, is the inability of people to resolve conflicts and get conflicts resolved or make meaningful compromises for the sake of a greater collective good or group betterment. I mean, as much as people push individualism, and I can appreciate some of that, it's also toxic to an extent because it's a, I want to get what I want at all times, and the moment I don't get exactly what I want, I'm out of a group. You know, so to be part of a group, you have to give up some of your autonomy and you have to give up some of what you want. But there are people out there who just like, screw it, I can just go do whatever I want and I don't want to be held accountable. Also, they don't want to be held accountable for their behavior. They don't want to be part of an institution or an organization or a group or a social gathering where it's an important part of their life, so if their behavior is out of line and they get called out, they can't leave and they have to change because it's too important to them. I think that that's what we're really seeing, is a lot of people do not want to be too invested in anything that they... It's the 30-second out rule. They don't want to grow emotionally attached to anything they can't walk out on in 30 seconds flat when they feel accountability coming around the corner. When somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, this way you behave, or this what you do, you know, I don't think you should be doing it. And instead of leaving because you're, you know, wanting to act immature, it's too painful for you to walk away and you are forced to become a better person. You're forced to grow up. And for all those who talk about living in, you know, praising or idealizing or romanticizing the rural life or rural areas, who've watched too many Hallmark Channel movies, they've watched too much old 60s TV shows depicting rural people as being, you know, whatever, being, you know, superior in terms of their manners and social etiquette. The rural areas where the societal institutions died first and died fastest and died the worst. It is in cities where you're going to find a little bit more of that, of those institutions still remaining. Where inertia has kept them together to an extent. That is all I've got for this podcast episode for this week. So tune into next week's episode and tjmartinell.com. If you found this podcast, you found my website. So buy books, people. Write reviews. Love the book. Love the reviews. So thank you for listening to this episode of the New Adventures of the Mountain Pass podcast. This is your host, TJ Martinell, coming to you from my living room in my my Fortress Americana in the heart of Cascadia. Signing off.